You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey guys, it's Lauren
and Chelsea,
and we're just popping in before this episode begins to explain why we're unlocking a recent Patreon episode.
Yeah, we're still on tour with our live show. We're in Chicago. I love it here. I may never come back.
No, that's not true. We do need to come back, Chelsea, because we've just announced our Los Angeles dates. That's right, LA fuckettes, and those in the Southern California area. We will be playing the Bourbon Room June 28th and June 29th. Tickets are available for both nights.
Please come see us. This is our hometown show. It can't be like sad Carrie at the Learning Annex vibes.
That's right. The East Coast has shown up for us, and we expect the same response from the West Coast. We will also be in San Francisco June 16th, Portland June 17th, and Seattle June 18th.
Please come see us, guys, or we'll cry ourselves to sleep every night.
Now, please enjoy this episode that we recently recorded about Cruel Intentions.
Also, guys, trigger warning. Of course, Cruel Intentions is based on the book Dangerous Liaisons. I understand that my pronunciation of these words is very upsetting, but I'm sorry. This is just how I talk.
All right, guys.
Liaison.
All right, guys. We'll be back next week with a pop culture episode to discuss all the things we've missed while we've been on tour.
Absolutely.
All right. We love you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Fairless.
And I'm Lauren Garoni, and today we are discussing the film Cruel Intentions.
Hallelujah. It's just like so insane how good that song is. Sorry, I can't get over it. It's like the chokehold that the Cruel Intentions soundtrack still has on me is so extreme.
We grew up in such a heyday of the movie soundtrack.
Yeah.
This is the only moment in time where, like, corporate collaborations were actually good. When it was like, okay, movie studio would go to their in-house record label and be like, who do you have that we can put on the soundtrack? And it was the best people.
Britpop was a popular genre of music. Alternative music was popular then. It's just not like that now. There just aren't bands like this.
This film is just aesthetically so perfect, and it has no reason to be. And what I mean by that is, it's a teen film, but every element from the script to the costumes to the soundtrack are so elevated.
Also, upon rewatching this movie, I realized it's a lot funnier than people give it credit for. Like, I don't feel like that gets enough acknowledgement. The humor is kind of overshadowed by the dark subject matter and the fact that teenagers are playing these very fucked up people and all of that. It's so fucking funny.
We think of a film like 10 Things I Hate About You as a comedy, but this is much more of a comedy than 10 Things I Hate About You, honestly.
Yeah.
We are a month off, but the reason we're doing this film is that it came out in March 25 years ago. Can you believe it, Chelsea?
25 years and 1 month ago. That has a great ring to it. It's just like there's a lot going on at the moment. So this episode has been delayed. Thank you for waiting.
I like how you're thanking them for waiting. They didn't even know it was coming.
I don't know. If they had seen it just getting pushed further and further down the calendar.
On our editorial calendar.
Onto a completely different month.
Where should we start?
Well, can we talk about the casting?
Absolutely.
I didn't watch Buffy.
Oh.
But I was familiar with Sarah Michelle Gellar because of I Know What You Did Last Summer. And I think that's probably why I was familiar with Ryan Phillippe as well. Although he was also in 54, which had come out before Cruel Intentions. And God, was he hot.
He's very hot.
Almost upsetting to look at, in that same way that, like, young Leonardo DiCaprio is upsetting to look at.
But Ryan Phillippe oddly never had a twink death.
Yeah, he's still looking good. Also, I saw his Instagram and, like, he's kind of, like, posting thirst traps still, which I get it. Like, he's still hot.
I think he does have a bit of Leonardo DiCaprio tendencies, let's say, which is, you know, kind of Leonardo DiCaprio gets away with it because he doesn't have children in the age range he dates, but Ryan Phillippe now does, and it has an extra layer of weird. I mean, very Sebastian Valmont of him.
But it makes sense because anyone that grew up watching Cruel Intentions or Titanic, like, it's like these men have warped our sexuality.
Sure. And now he's still available to us. I remember having a crush on Leonardo DiCaprio, like you did as well, Chelsea. Even at 11, I'm like, oh, I'm too young. He would never date me. And then it's like I aged out of the age range that Leonardo DiCaprio would date, and now I'm too old for Leonardo DiCaprio.
That's fucked up. But also when you're young, it's like a 4-year age difference feels like 2 decades. Although, what? How old is Leo?
49.
Okay, so he is significantly older than you still.
What about it, Chelsea?
But yes, you are too old for him. You might as well be the elderly woman on the Titanic. Also, we have to talk about Reese Witherspoon. At this point, she had really been doing jailbait movies pretty much exclusively. When you think about Freeway, Election, which was the highbrow jailbait movie, Fear, of course, which we're going to have to discuss one of these days. All such good movies. Also, Reese Witherspoon, I don't know, she looks a lot like my girlfriend from high school. So I feel like Reese Witherspoon at this age holds an extra special place in my heart.
Oh, Chelsea.
Aw.
Entertainment Weekly did an oral history of the making of this film. And the only reason that Reese Witherspoon is in this film is because Ryan Phillippe begged her to be in this film.
Yeah, I read that too. And I didn't realize that they had already been dating. I just assumed that they met on the set and like sparks flew, but they were already together.
They had their child the year that this movie came out.
I texted it to you. I'll put it in the show notes on Patreon. But the way that Bruce Weber photo of them with baby Ava from the Vanity Fair Hollywood issue is burned into my brain. To me, it's like the quintessential portrait of a young family.
To go back to Sarah Michelle Gellar's casting, so I did not see this movie in theaters. Basically, anyone that this film was meant for, i.e. teenagers, didn't go to see it because it was rated R. So a lot of people snuck into this film.
Well, did they ever enforce rated R? Because I saw it in a theater. The only time I've ever been turned away from a film was Eyes Wide Shut. And then I just made my dad take me, which was a fun daddy-daughter movie date, I have to say.
Should we do an Eyes Wide Shut episode? Another film that came out in 1999, but with our dads.
Oh, God.
It's a 4-hour episode. But I was 11 when this movie came out, so it was definitely a blockbuster film. And I distinctly remember one of the first DVDs I ever owned, because this is the apex of my obsession with Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Sarah Michelle Gellar. I saw it all in theaters, evidently except this movie, but I saw Simply Irresistible in theaters to support my girl. And the dedication that Sarah Michelle Gellar had, Chelsea, this woman came off of season 2 of Buffy, arguably the best season. We can discuss it in the comments, fuckettes. She dyes her hair brown for this movie. All of her agents go, no, you're Buffy, you're the good girl. Why would you want to do this movie? And she's like, have you read the script? It's incredible. Then she gets her hair back to platinum blonde as if nothing happened for season 3 of Buffy.
Wow, that's a beautiful story. But what a great colorist.
Yeah, the fact that her hair never fell out. The character did cut her hair into a bob in season 6, so maybe the blonde was getting to her at a certain point.
Her character in this film is just so good. Not totally dissimilar from her character in I Know What You Did Last Summer. Like, way more evil for sure, but like still a bitch. And I think bitch is a very good role for Sarah Michelle Gellar. It seems like a bit of a subversion.
So what you're saying is let Sarah Michelle Gellar be a bitch again.
Let her be a bitch.
Rounding out this cast is Selma Blair, oldest of the cast, ironically enough, playing the youngest person in the cast.
Yeah, this was her big breakthrough role. But I remember she got a ton of press when this came out. Like, I instantly knew who Selma Blair was. She was immediately wearing, like, you know, spangly, like, Narciso Rodriguez slip dresses. She was, like, on the cover of Flaunt magazine, like that kind of vibe.
Fashion icon. The writer-director Roger Cumble would have to, during the audition process, be like, not to be weird, but how old are you? And he legit thought she was 15. She's like, I'm 25. And he was like, all right, you got this role.
I rewatched Dangerous Liaisons because I wanted to prepare for this episode. Guys, it's truly the best double feature in the world ever. But in Dangerous Liaisons, the Selma Blair character is naive because she has grown up in a convent because they wanted to keep her pure before she made her debut in society. That's why she's so childlike. Selma Blair's character, I don't know if it was written this way or if it was a choice made by Selma Blair, but she feels neurodivergent. Like, it's not like she's just sheltered.
You're saying it's giving Lena Dunham's sharp stick?
It's very much giving Lena Dunham's sharp stick. A predecessor to sharp stick for sure.
I'm just gonna say Dangerous Liaisons. I was surprised to find out that the writer-director Roger Cumble, who this is his directorial debut. So when people talk about white male privilege in the Hollywood industry, this is what they're talking about. Like, this man had never directed a film before, and a studio was like, here's $30 million. Why not?
And you know what? He slayed, but also, was he gay? I'm very curious to know this, because one noteworthy thing about Cruel Intentions is it is unusually queer for a film about high school kids, but also all of the gay male cultural references in the movie speak to, like, baby boomer age gays. Like, is Joshua Jackson watching Spartacus? Like, that's crazy.
Would you be surprised to learn, Chelsea, that no, he's been married to a woman since the year 2000?
It's interesting that it has that slant, but on the other hand, the way that certain things are written, I can believe that it wasn't written by a gay man.
I think the more upsetting thing to me is, because this film is so aesthetically significant and made such an impact on me and what movies could be, could look like, that he has not gone on to direct as major of a film. I mean, he did direct The Sweetest Thing. Recently, he's been known for directing those after films, like After We Collided. They're based on Harry Styles fanfic. You could make fan fiction look major, but this is not that. Anyway.
Well, also in that oral history, I was fascinated to learn that he was inspired to write this film after watching Welcome to the Dollhouse, which is such a different movie. It's about even younger people, and it's way more fucked up. But I like that he was just like, oh, I want to write a fucked up movie about teenagers.
Yeah, and he caught the zeitgeist perfectly because it was a time where a lot of studios were making films that were teenage adaptations of Shakespeare. This is not Shakespeare. This is the French book Dangerous Liaisons, which again, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce the book the French way or say the author's name. Just insert one of those Google pronunciations. You know, it takes two to tango. It takes two to make a film. It was a time where the studio that made it was looking for films that, quote, showed young people in adult situations, which this very much is.
Dawson's Creek was already popular at this point. That was a very noteworthy thing about that series. When I was watching this, I was like, Gossip Girl would not exist without Cruel Intentions.
So now that we've spent a good 10 minutes talking about how much we love this film, shall we get into the film itself?
Sure.
We begin with Sebastian driving to therapy. I love that this continues the grand tradition in film and television of teen boys driving insanely impractical vintage cars. Oh, I also love that it says that this isn't an adaptation of Dangerous Liaisons. In the opening credit, it says it is a suggestion of Dangerous Liaisons.
It's pretty close to the source material.
I was surprised to learn, because I did go back as well and watch the 1988-1989, the Stephen Frears adaptation you're speaking of. I didn't realize that an invention of this movie is that they're stepbrother and sister.
Instead of, I think, their ex-lover. And the
yeah, they're fuck buddies.
They're like sinister fuck buddies.
And something I did not realize until this rewatch is that Sebastian, by the way, what is our choice? We always have to make the choice. Are we saying actors' names or character names?
I think we can say Sebastian, Annette, who's the Reese Witherspoon character, Catherine, who is Sarah Michelle Gellar, and then everyone else can be the character actors.
We're not saying Cecile, we're saying...
Okay, we can say Cecile. But everyone else is like, I don't know what Christine Baranski's character's name is.
It was not until this rewatch that I learned that Susie Kurtz, who is the actress that plays Sebastian's therapist, is the Christine Baranski role in the Stephen Frears adaptation.
Cecile's mother.
Yes, a lovely little nod.
And this is such a funny scene. So Sebastian is in therapy because his parents have sent him because he's obsessed with sex.
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly born out of a post-Woody Allen neurotic, you know, anyone that grows up in New York is put into therapy as a child.
We also see a really great fake book that Swoozie Kurtz has written called Good Parenting.
I love the moment where she lets him have the book and then you see her write in her notes to charge him for it. This is such a masterclass of, one, a character introduction, but he is a piece of shit, but as an audience, we're on his side because we don't like this therapist either.
Yes, and you can tell that she sees right through him and does think that he's a little piece of shit.
Yet, if the parents are paying, she will take their money. We establish that Swoozie Kurtz has a daughter in Tara Reid, whose photo is on the desk. A lot of showing, not telling what is about to happen. Sebastian says during therapy when he sees the photo of Tara Reid, "This is the type of girl I should be with." And Swoozie Kurtz is like, "She's too good for you."
Which, imagine your therapist saying that to you.
You know what? He had every right to do what he did.
He leaves, and then Swoozie Kurtz gets a call from Tara Reid, who is hysterically sobbing. There's nudie pictures of her on the internet.
How could you be so stupid?
Her breakdown has the exact same vibe as Patty Duke's breakdowns in Valley of the Dolls.
Right.
Like, it's giving that. There's nudie pictures of me.
I feel that this was so ahead of its time. Like, a movie in 1998 to make a website as a blackmail tactic. Because this is straight up revenge porn, is what we call it these days.
This is probably where I learned what revenge porn was.
This is also such a wonderful era of film where not everyone had a cell phone. It was the infancy of the internet. You could kind of do anything with it. Sebastian taught himself HTML overnight.
Yeah, GeoCities. He's no stranger to some light HTML.
This is a website you couldn't even make with Squarespace widgets today.
That's one thing that I think is great about this movie is that the characters are quite smart. Not Cecile, obviously, but everyone else.
Correct. That's the other reason as an audience you can get on their side.
Like, he's smart enough to make a GeoCities website and be able to drive a stick shift.
I can't do either today.
Same. Tara Reid says that, you know, this guy manipulated me and he said he wanted to photograph me and he said he had killer legs and Swoozie Kurtz, and alarm bells go off because Sebastian has just told the therapist that she has amazing legs.
I'd love to photograph you sometime.
So she like dramatically runs out of the office, sees Sebastian in the lobby below and starts banging on a plate glass window like that scene from The Graduate.
Yeah, and then she's dragged away by security. I'm on Swoozie Kurtz's side where she's like, "Let go of me." It's like, it is her office, her floor.
And Sebastian, of course, has already picked up another girl.
Who, do we think that he bedded her or didn't?
I think he was doing that just to piss off Swoozie Kurtz. I think he probably just dumped her the second they got outside.
Sebastian returns home. The apartment exterior shown in this movie is the Ukrainian Cultural Center, which is on 5th Avenue and 79th Street. I'm a little embarrassed to say that the first time I went to New York, I was like, okay, great, let's go to the Met, but also I need to just look at this
Ukrainian Cultural Center.
My mom's like, why? I'm like, no reason, don't worry about it. Take a photo of me in front of you.
So we meet Catherine, played by Sarah Michelle Gellar, Cecile, and Christine Baranski, Cecile's fabulous mother.
Mrs. Caldwell.
Cecile is joining whatever private school Catherine goes to in the fall, and she wants Catherine to like guide her.
Yeah, we learn later in the film that Catherine is student body president, which is not something I was expecting. Selma Blair does this great thing. I don't know if it was scripted where her knees are fully open.
It was definitely scripted.
I don't know. She might have added that touch. And then Sebastian asks her how things are going down under because she's got a kangaroo shirt on.
A koala shirt.
Sorry, a koala shirt.
Know your Australian animals.
I got to. Costumes. Dialogue. It's all firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
So Christine Baranski and Cecile leave. Christine Baranski has this line as they're leaving, which makes her such a perfect Upper East Side Karen, which is, keep your legs closed. This isn't Jamaica.
A problematic queen. Let's just say that.
And then Catherine does something that I think altered every millennial from you and me to Lana Del Rey's mind, which is she unscrews her cross and it has a Coke spoon. It's a Coke cross, Chelsea.
I know. I actually bought that Lana Del Rey necklace, but it broke.
We both have one.
Oh, is yours still working?
It's in operating order.
In addition to busting out her Coke spoon, she also takes off her blazer to reveal a really insane corset top. And this is a nice throwback to Dangerous Liaisons, but also very in keeping with fashion at the time and Dolce & Gabbana and Stella McCartney's Chloe. We were seeing a lot of corsets in that period anyway.
But certainly in no way, shape, or form what teenagers, even the richest.
Also, I don't know who needs to hear this, but like teenagers in the 90s didn't wear heels like to school. Catherine has stilettos on 24/7 in Cruel Intentions.
She must have been watching Carrie from season one.
Yeah, it's very much that vibe.
Secret sex? Hello, my life.
So now we get our first glimpse into the sick and depraved step-sibling relationship that these two people share, which is really like some dom sub weird twisted shit.
If they want to fuck so badly, they could have fucked.
I know, because it seems like Catherine does want to fuck, but I guess she just wants to torture him more than she wants to fuck.
Sebastian says he needs a challenge, and Cecile is not a challenge and doesn't understand exactly what Catherine wants to do with Cecile. And she explains that she wants to ruin Cecile to get back at her boyfriend who dumped her over July 4th weekend.
Who dumped her for Cecile.
Yes. Memorial Day.
And Ryan Phillippe's like, this is way too easy. I have my sights set on something bigger. This random virgin who is our future headmaster's daughter, who has written this essay in 17 magazine about why she wants to wait to have sex, which is so perfect.
It works for the time period. I was trying to think about if they tried to do this today, what would it be? Like a daily episode or something?
Or she would be like a virginity influencer or something like that. Even as like a whatever 12-year-old 17 reader, when I saw this film, I would have made fun of her for this article. But also, it looked so legit having read 17 and religiously in that era. It was totally the kind of thing they would publish.
The bet is that if Sebastian can bed Annette, he gets to fuck his stepsister. But if he doesn't, then he has to give his car to Catherine?
That does not seem like a fair bet to me. But it's not that he gets to fuck her. He gets to put it anywhere.
That was the 90s equivalent of you can color outside the lines.
Okay, but I love that these step-siblings are so sexually advanced that not only are they in this, like, kinky relationship, but she's also experienced enough having anal sex to be like, yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
Well, he could put it anywhere. He might put it in her ear, Chelsea. They're weird people.
They're full freaks.
These are 17-year-olds that somehow have the sexual experience that, like, we don't even have.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get there. One thing I love about this movie is that it's established in this scene that their parents are just absent. They're traveling. These kids are living basically by themselves in this insane Ukrainian cultural institute or whatever.
They could take cabs. They're shopping at Calvin Klein. They can take care of themselves.
They're very self-sufficient.
Yes, as an original 90210 watcher, this is all very Dylan McKay coded, where somehow he owned a home and drove a vintage Porsche and had no adult supervision. So now we get the introduction of Reese Witherspoon as Annette, who is, wouldn't you know it, Chelsea, at Ryan Phillippe's aunt's house upstate.
Sebastian immediately is like, I disagree with the thesis of your 17 article.
The fact that she isn't immediately like, so you regularly read 17 magazine?
I know. Like, how did you even find an old issue of 17?
So then, of course, he has to immediately ask, because his charm is not working on her, which is so weird, are you a lesbian?
And she's like, no. He's like, oh, I just picked up on that vibe. But her whole thing is that she just doesn't believe that teenagers are mature enough to be able to process the emotions that come with having sex.
Yeah, it's not a weird religious thing.
Which is refreshing, honestly.
Still a dumb take.
Still a terrible take.
The other thing that stuck out in the scene to me is, my God, the cut of the chinos that Reese Witherspoon is wearing is so late 90s and looked good on nobody.
I know.
I don't think you could even find them anymore. I think we burned them all.
No, I think you can find them. It's just like they're marketed towards adult women, like in department stores. Oh, actually, wait, those don't exist. What am I even talking about? I'm sure we can find them on Amazon. But what she should have been wearing was that Gap swing dancing type chino.
So we're back at Christine Baranski's apartment where Cecile is with Sean Patrick Thomas as Ronald,
her cello instructor. He's attending pre-Juilliard and writing his first opera based on Martin Luther King, and Cecile is like, I love you. Kind of immediately.
White leg sharing clueless. She goes, Dr. King's my favorite.
Very funny.
Catherine is creeping on them and throws her Vietnamese lady servant, who is with her, under the bus by just hitting something off of the bookcase so it falls, and Cecile and Ronald are aware of their presence. And she goes, My Lee, be careful. That woman just rolls her eyes. I was like, why is that woman with Sarah Michelle Gellar? And I realized in watching this, the picnic scene happens right afterwards. She's holding a picnic set. That's why this woman is there.
Right. Meanwhile, across town, Sebastian is venting to Joshua Jackson.
I feel like this is a good time to explain that a majority of this film was actually shot in Los Angeles, because that is a home in the flats of Beverly Hills.
Joshua Jackson is a preppy weed dealer.
This is a character straight out of Less Than Zero. He is weighing weed. He's got bleach blonde hair.
Yeah, and at the time that this film came out, it was very progressive that a straight male character would have a gay friend. Like, that was not a dynamic that we saw very often in films, because at that time it's like you might assume that Ryan Phillippe was gay by association. Sebastian, I'm sorry.
It's fine. We're gonna go back and forth.
I'm trying to be consistent, guys.
Yeah, but they weren't progressive enough to actually cast a gay actor to play this role. Although I guess the only out actor at the time was Rupert Everett, who wouldn't have really worked.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. Joshua Jackson was perfect in this role. And also it's cool that his character has like much more self-respect than the average gay character of that era. Didn't seem particularly tortured about his life.
No, and you know, was doing his part to out closeted straight men. We forgot to mention that Annette also doesn't fuck with Ryan Phillippe, which this is taken from the book, because she has been getting letters. Someone has written her letters
warning her about him specifically.
And so he goes to Joshua Jackson to figure out who that could possibly be. And all that Joshua Jackson could think of is the Grickster.
Played by the guy that played Jenny's husband on The L Word, which I always forget about every single time I see this movie.
That is only how I know this actor.
Yeah, I've never seen him in anything else but these two things.
So Sebastian is like, oh, I fingered his girlfriend at homecoming. That's probably why he hates me. And Joshua Jackson has to be like, I don't think that's it.
He, you know, drunkenly hooked up with Joshua Jackson a few times and was like a toxic closet case.
And why does he keep putting up with him? Because that man has a mouth like a Hoover.
So Sebastian is like, can you arrange a little get together with him and suss it out? And he's like, no, I gotta watch Spartacus.
Come over around midnight. So now we get the infamous park scene. I remember my little Sarah Michelle Gellar loving heart. There were paparazzi photos of this in People magazine when this was shot.
Of them kissing or of them just sitting in the park?
I remember it being them sitting in the park. I don't know if it was the actual kissing part.
This scene is so iconic. Of course, Cecile is like stressed because she's inexperienced. And she's venting about it to Catherine. And Catherine's like, let's just make out in broad daylight in the middle of this park, as if this would be something that like two teenage girls would do, especially two straight teenage girls, or assuming they're straight. I don't know. Cecile liked it a little too much, I think. I think Catherine's just crazy.
Well, this lends itself to the fact that the writer-director is a straight man, because only a straight man would be like, this is what two teenage girls do to get experience. There is a great moment where Cecile starts talking about the boy that she's seeing, who is Catherine's ex, and talks about the bulimic head case that he dumped.
I know, this is the only time her bulimia is referenced, sadly.
Catherine is brushing Cecile's hair. Again, something teenage girls love to do, and just yanks it hard when she says that.
Well, I think it's just reinforcing this twisted, like, mother-daughter dynamic that she's establishing with Cecile. but this is such an iconic moment. I remember when they won Best Kiss at the VMAs that year. I remember all the parodies of it, and specifically like that string of saliva.
Obviously, you could say it was a stunt that it won the Best Kiss at the MTV Movie Awards, but it's one of the best movie kisses out there, I'm going to say, certainly of the last 25 years.
Also, they're making out to Blur's Coffee and TV. Sick.
Cecile herself also has a whole collection of boyfriends because she's got Court, who's Catherine's ex. But then this is the scene where she reveals that Ronald has been sending her love letters and Catherine offers to help her.
But of course, she has the most sinister intentions. Back at Sebastian's aunt's house.
I'm going to be me for a second, but the speed at which they are able to exit the city and get to, I'm going to hope Westchester, but seems like the Hamptons.
It truly seems like it's like a 20-minute drive. Sebastian is blasting opera music throughout the house because he wants to seduce Annette with a sexy romantic swim.
And of course, he's got to show his ass. She goes up to get her bathing suit. He then briefly calls Catherine, which this is their exchange. Catherine goes, fucker yet? Sebastian goes, soon. Catherine goes, loser. Sebastian goes, blow me. End of call.
What an efficient conversation.
There's no reason for him to call Catherine, but I find this interaction very funny. Annette comes down in her lovely one piece.
Her modest one piece.
And Sebastian has taken a little steam, as you do before you get into, did we say it was an indoor pool?
Yeah, your aunt's indoor pool.
And so, of course, she catches him with his butt out.
It really is quite an ass, I have to say. And in that oral history, like, Ryan Phillippe was like, oh my God, all these gay guys are constantly coming up to me and being like, I knew I was gay when I saw your ass. And it's like, yeah, I bet that happens to him on a weekly basis.
Did this movie make you question your sexuality because you too loved his ass so much?
No, I think it's just like really speaks to the beauty of the male physique.
He is a Greek statue.
It's also the way like the ass was lit, like the whole environment, like it was very glam.
Sebastian's game does not work on Annette at all.
No, she's still resisting.
And she might have a point, right? Her virginity is not rooted in religion, but just the fact that she's like, I can't handle this. And she saw that ass and she's like, I can't handle this.
She was flustered by the ass, as anyone would be. Sebastian suddenly is back in the city, like 2 seconds later.
Or is Joshua Jackson's house also upstage?
I have no idea. Anyway, Joshua Jackson has just fucked Tim from the L word.
The Gregster.
And Ryan Phillippe bursts in. Again, this man is so not homophobic that he has no problem catching two guys fucking.
That's his save the cat moment.
Yeah.
This character is reprehensible, but he's not a total piece of shit because he's not homophobic. And you would think this character would be.
True. He has at least one gay friend. Also, Joshua Jackson is just so down to be like this sort of sinister femme fatale twink who just immediately sparks up a cigarette.
What do you think Joshua Jackson's motivations are? Because he almost instantly realizes that Greg couldn't be the person writing the letters because he can barely put two words together.
Yeah, he's talking to Sebastian. He's like, dude, like this guy can't write a grocery list. Like he couldn't write a whole ass letter to save his life.
But Sebastian is like, fine, you know Annette because Midwestern things, I guess. You're going to tell her I'm a good person. And then it cuts to them on the beach.
Yeah. And he's blackmailing him into doing this specifically because he has caught him fucking Joshua Jackson.
Which this is the late 90s. And the worst thing a straight man could be is accidentally outed.
Even with like the hottest less than zero twink on the Upper East Side.
The Gregster and Annette are walking on the beach. He's doing his all to try to sell Sebastian as a good person. And yet again, understandably, Annette's like, I'm not sure because what you're describing is not the person that I've met the last three times. Greg goes, do I look like a gossip queen to you? She's like, I don't know. I've been getting these letters. And he's like, who is writing the letters? And she goes, I don't know if I should tell you, which is like, why?
Well, she's clearly a very discreet woman.
But Greg is not, because even though he said he wasn't a gossip queen, he is. And there's a very funny scene at a payphone where he is checking out men using the outdoor showers as he tells Sebastian that, guess what? Guess who's been writing the letters, Chelsea? Uh-oh, it's Christine Baranski.
I knew that bitch was up to no good.
Now we have Catherine, who has set up a secret camera to watch Cecile and Ronald's cello lessons.
And they're clearly falling in love.
Also, what Cecile does when she says goodbye to Ronald does lend itself to the sharp stick of it all, which is she lifts herself up and then sticks her legs out so that he can fully see her underwear, which you get the impression that she's not doing that to be salacious.
No, she's like flashed everyone on the Upper East Side in like the first 45 minutes of this film.
Oh my God. And then he goes to leave because he's weirded out and she just goes, peace out. Which Selma Blair is ungodly good at being incredibly cringe.
So Sebastian and Catherine catch up. Sebastian is in this insane black turtleneck and these little glasses. It's like full Left Bank, like beatnik cosplay, essentially, but like the 90s version of that.
Yeah, it's giving a big in season two. I see that.
It's also a little bit Steve Jobs.
So now Sebastian is down to be part of Catherine's scheme because it is Cecile's mom who is writing the letters to Annette.
And then Catherine grinds on his lap in this way.
A lot of clothed erotic massages going on in this film.
Very sophisticated for teenagers, but that's why we live for this movie.
Right, because she's touching his dick and says that things are looking up and then asks if he's succeeded with Annette yet. And because he hasn't, she leaves him hanging.
So Sebastian then calls Annette and is like, oh, did I leave my glasses at my aunt's house? And she's like, what are you really calling about? And he's like, I miss you and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And for some reason, she decides to hang out with him, I guess because Tim from the L Word has reassured her that he's not a monster.
I was convinced that this scene was part of a falling in love montage. There's just music playing and they walk through Central Park at dusk. And that's it. So now it's seemingly the next morning. Catherine has Christine Baranski in a Bunny McDougal-esque pink tweed Chanel suit and reveals that Cecile and Ronald are having a secret romance. Catherine goes, I know, it's shocking because she's so young. And then Christine Baranski goes, and he's so black.
There's a certain campiness to her overt racism in this movie that really comes out of the next scene.
The sales associate is giving her a coffee as she says this, and she goes sugar, I mean no sugar. So yeah, the next scene is Christine Baranski's character confronting Cecile and Ronald with the letters.
And she's like, I got you off the street. And he's like, I live on 59th and Park.
Oh, don't give me that racism, bitch. My husband and I gave money to Colin Powell.
Maybe the campiest moment of this entire film. I love Christine Baranski. I think she's the best part of whatever she's in usually. And I think Cruel Intentions is no exception.
So it would seem that after the clothing store, Catherine called Sebastian and was like, meet me in the lobby of Mrs. Caldwell's building. We need to catch the elevator as soon as he comes out of it.
When Ronald comes out, they're waiting down there in like black sunglasses, like they're FBI agents or something.
Except for Cecile, the characters who are getting duped at least have the presence of mind to ask repeatedly, wait, why are you helping me? Because this is when Sebastian and Catherine lay out their plan to help Ronald. Which Ronald wants to make contact with her, but as he notes, he doesn't have her cell phone number or her email, to which Sebastian has the great line, Ronald, email is for geeks and pedophiles.
Not wrong.
Because it's the beginning of internet culture, not everyone has an email address. You can, one, get away with that line, but two, it makes sense of why they would still be passing around letters. If you did that in a movie today, it would be fully insane.
No, the joke no longer makes sense, but it hits even more because of how much time has gone by. So Sebastian starts to have second thoughts.
Crazy. He has this moment of reflection because Catherine's about to call Cecile because the plan is to de-virginize her and ruin her reputation in time for the start of the school year. Sebastian goes, are you sure you want to do this? And Sarah Michelle Gellar as Catherine has this great, like, I've thought about it. Yeah, it's fine. And he's like, no, no, no. We are destroying an innocent girl. You do realize that.
And then she wins him over with her, like, evil version of America Ferrera's Barbie speech, essentially.
We should play it here.
You amaze me.
Eat me, Sebastian. It's all right for guys like you in court to fuck everyone, but when I do it, I get dumped for innocent little twits like Cecile. God forbid I exude confidence and enjoy sex. Do you think I relish the fact that I have to act like Mary Sunshine 24/7 so I can be considered a lady? I'm the Marcia fucking Brady of the Upper East Side, and sometimes I want to kill myself. So there's your psychoanalysis, Dr. Freud. Now tell me, are you in or are you out?
I'm the Marsha fucking Brady of the Upper East Side, and sometimes I want to kill myself.
This is the closest thing to the humor of Heathers, which also has to be an influence on this film on some level.
Which is probably why I loved it so much.
Yeah, it's like the jokes about bulimia, all that stuff feels very much like that film.
Yeah, because this has the same cadence and delivery of fuck me gently with a chainsaw, what do I look like, Mother Teresa, to you?
Yeah, totally.
She is making a solid point, which is, because I am enlightened, which asterisk, I'm enlightened in a way that no 17-year-old girl will be or has ever been.
Yeah, she's basically Madonna's character in the Bad Girl video, but she's like 16.
I was gonna say Madonna in Body of Evidence.
Yeah, that too.
As a 17-year-old. But yeah, basically she's like, they hate me because I'm confident and sexy.
And she has to live up to all of these stereotypes. You know, she's student body president. She's, I don't know, a well-to-do socialite, essentially.
Yeah, I guess because we've only ever seen Catherine be a Machiavellian bitch. In this speech, you realize, like, oh, she is perceived as a goody-two-shoes.
Which is so fun.
By the way, Sebastian, after that speech, gives up his, like, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't do this very quickly. He's like, all right, give me the phone.
Men can be feminists, Lauren.
For a brief moment. So Cecile comes over. She evidently has a life-size doll that looks enough like her that she can put in the bed to fool her mom.
Because she still plays with dolls.
How old is Cecile? Like, she's going into freshman year. She's 14. It's a little old to be playing with dolls.
Yeah, true.
She comes over to Sebastian's apartment. She's wearing a red hoodie, which, Chell, Little Red Riding Hood reference.
Do they actually say that? Or is that just your interpretation? Because I so never got that.
It is in the IMDb trivia. I will embarrassingly say I didn't need the IMDb trivia because I own this DVD and used to listen to the film commentary.
Wow.
The director says that was the reference.
So he gets her drunk on Long Island iced teas.
So dumb, but it is my favorite joke. When she goes, this doesn't taste like iced tea, and he goes, it's from Long Island. Mwah. Also, have you ever had a Long Island iced tea?
Of course. Have you never?
No.
That's insane.
All right, well, I'll drink one.
No. You don't need to drink one. The time has passed, but like, it's more just like one of those drinks that young people really like an amaretto sour.
One far classier than the other, but yes.
It's crazy because a Long Island iced tea has every kind of hard liquor in it, but yet they all cancel each other out. So it's like, it doesn't even taste alcoholic.
That's the danger of it. I think because of this film and what happens afterwards, I think something went into my brain that was like, don't have a Long Island iced tea.
And that was for the best, but you know what? You might have to try one.
Okay.
We'll go to the Abbey and get you one.
It feels like a drink one should have at Dallas. Alice BBQ.
Exactly. So he's like, Cecile, you could model, but you're not sexy, so I guess not. She's like, I can be sexy. Then he tries to get her to take all of her clothes off so he can take photos of her.
This scene is not great, but the 88 adaptation of this is way worse. John Malkovich straight up assaults Uma Thurman.
Things were more rapey in the 18th century than they were in 1999.
For sure. And the way that they get around this, they don't fully have sex. He goes down on her.
He's basically blackmailing her by being like, I'm going to call your mom to pick you up if you don't do this. This is one thing that it's like you actually couldn't do this as written today. I think most other aspects of this film hold up. You could make this exact movie now, but the moment has passed for this kind of shit.
No, because that's quite literally what Harvey Weinstein did to actresses.
Yes. But also it's kind of confusing, and it's like the same thing in Dangerous Liaisons, because it's like the day after Uma Thurman and Selma Blair's characters are acting as if they have been raped or sexually assaulted. But like then like a light switch flips and they're both like super into it.
Yeah, they're instantaneously nymphs.
Again, I think this is like another like straight male writer kind of thing.
I love when movies do fake outs like this, which is it's the next morning, Christine Baranski tries to wake up Cecile, finds the doll. Cecile just appears in the doorway and Christine Baranski drops that there's a doll there.
And she looks like insane. It's such a funny moment, though. Her hair is just all fucked up. Like, it's a very exaggerated way of telling the audience that she's had an orgasm and been up late and whatever else.
And because in this world, upstate New York is 20 minutes away from the Upper East Side, Cecile is back at Sebastian's aunt's house. Annette's there. Sebastian's there. He strokes the tennis racket quite seductively, which makes Cecile run off.
Yes, very creepy. And then Sebastian and Annette go to the old folks' home and visit people with dementia.
Yes, because Sebastian's aunt has opera tickets. And I guess she was supposed to go do this. I don't love this scene. As someone with grandparents in a memory care unit, the fact that he lies to that woman while he's sitting in a chair doing the crossword.
No, obviously he's a monster. I wouldn't say this is like one of the more fun parts of the film. I think the fun part of the film is when they're driving home in the convertible and they listen to Praise You by Fatboy Slim and Reese Witherspoon makes those crazy faces.
Yeah, because Sebastian's still in his sociopath mode is like, I think she was really neat and I had fun. And of course, Annette's not falling for any of this. And then he does the really emotionally manipulative thing, which is, I can't win with you. And then Annette correctly points out that he needs to lighten up. So she makes these crazy faces, which you can tell that this is not acting. And nothing against them. They are brilliant in this film. But this is very much a girlfriend making her boyfriend laugh with faces that she does.
Well, also these faces that she makes are crazy. Like, it's kind of amazing that she went there. I feel like a lot of actresses would be too vain to make faces that are like this wacky.
This is a couple who's been together and they feel comfortable with each other doing that.
Yeah, that's what makes it such a brilliant and humanizing moment.
And then they laugh and it's all good and they hold hands, which means they're basically dating now.
So back in Manhattan, Catherine goes to check on Cecile.
I think this is upstate, Chelsea. I think Catherine got a cab and in 15 minutes she was upstate as well. Hello, step aunt. I'm just gonna hang out here for the weekend. Is that cool?
And Cecile tells Catherine that Sebastian went down on her.
Well, she says, your brother forced himself on me. And then when Cecile explains it, Catherine goes, oh no, he just went down on you and he gave you an orgasm. So therefore, it's okay. And then Catherine's advice is to sleep with as many people as possible. Everybody does it, just nobody talks about it.
It's a great scene. And it's a great scene in Dangerous Liaisons as well, when Glenn Close is telling Uma Thurman like that she just needs to be a total hoe. It's kind of the best.
Selma Blair does this great dance because she's like, oh, we're like in a secret society.
It's such a bizarre character. She made some fascinating choices and she certainly took a lot of risks with this.
So next scene, Cecile is eating cherries after being de-virginized. Maraschino cherries, which is not a good snack.
Yeah, and she tries to fuck Sebastian again and he just like pushes her off the bed.
But she correctly clocks that Sebastian does love Annette.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. She's de-virginized and immediately horny because when he leaves her to write his diary in peace, she says, you want a blowjob?
Oh yeah, have we mentioned that he has a diary that he's constantly writing in that Catherine is desperate to read? That will be important later.
So it's the next morning, and Catherine sees Annette for the very first time, which I always forget about this, that these characters actually never meet until the end of the film.
Right.
And Catherine correctly notes, this woman is really getting to you, isn't she? And then Sebastian's like, yeah, you're right. Hey, enemy who I know blackmails everyone, let me give you some really personal information that yes, I am actually falling for this person.
So he goes to Annette, who's reading her book and having her nice little picnic, and kind of just like yells at her.
Yes, it starts with a nice little peck on the cheek, then the other cheek, then the lips, then he full on starts making out with her, and then she pushes him off of her because, you know, not what she was expecting. He's sorry, but he's not sorry. Annette goes, why, you say we could be friends. Why can't we just be friends? Yeah, this is where he does yell at her. He goes, you don't have a husband unless you're married to Jesus, which again, funny line.
And she's like, I don't trust myself with you. And then he storms off.
This scene made me wonder, do these movies hit with teenagers because like we as teenagers are amped up about everything? Or are teenagers emotionally amped up because we watch movies like this and think this is how love is supposed to be?
No, we're amped up to begin with. And I think that's also another reason why it's like stories about young people are interesting to adults because everything is very like extreme in that way.
And so she can't hold back anymore. They make out. She goes to unbutton his pants, which every time I watch this, I'm like, that's kind of a sophisticated seduction move for a virgin.
Yeah, I would be like scared.
She unbuttons her blouse and he just can't do it.
He has a moral crisis. I guess he is a human being after all and doesn't want to defile this sweet girl that is probably in love with him, that he's coerced into fucking him.
But don't worry, in a scene he'll get her there and he'll get himself there. This is also something that only happens in movies, which is when a character talks to themselves in the mirror and he just looks into a mirror, he excuses himself, goes into his bedroom. Thankfully, there's a mirror there above the fireplace and he just goes, "Get it together, you pussy."
I've definitely talked to myself in a mirror once or twice. Not like regularly, but you never have uttered a word.
No, that's what my inner monologue's for.
I wonder what I was saying.
Get it together, you pussy.
Probably, literally.
Catherine wakes Sebastian up the next morning. He was doing some late night shirtless diary writing.
And yeah, she, of course, is wearing like full strappy sandals, stilettos, crawling on him in bed.
She's like, "I just watched the best season 2 episode of Sex and the City."
She tries to read his diary, but he won't let her. And he admits that he choked.
Yes, because Annette is leaving, Catherine assumes he must have done the deed, so she's ready to fuck him. And he yet again admits, like, "Actually, I didn't." He could just lie and be like, "Yeah, I did."
So Sebastian calls Greg, who is throwing away all of his gay CDs. Again, he's throwing away, like, Judy Garland CDs and disco CDs. It's like, if he's gay in 1999, he's listening to, like, the Pet Shop Boys and Madonna and stuff.
And secretly is listening to the Rent soundtrack.
Yeah, exactly. Where's the Rent soundtrack?
Somehow Greg knows that Annette will be at Grand Central Station.
I do have to say, I love the scene on the escalator. It's iconic. It's so well shot. He's so hot on the top of the escalator. It's like she really had no choice at that point.
Right. And the costume designer put them in primary colors and then everyone else, all the extras, in grays.
That also feels like something that would happen in like a 90s electronica or like Brit pop music video.
Chelsea, as someone who's lived in Los Angeles and New York, did this look like the New York subway system to you?
Absolutely not.
No, this was shot at the LA Metro downtown. And then they make love.
They do make love. And I have to say, very good, realistic sex scene.
This is maybe the best, it's going to sound weird saying this, best teen sex scene. It seemed less weird when I thought to say that than coming out of my mouth. But
I'm calling the cops.
It's not just one of the best teen sex scenes, but it's one of the best, I would say, just in general, sex scenes in a film.
Set to Colorblind by the Counting Crows, we can't really separate it from the music, which is perfect. Not that I was the biggest like Counting Crows fan, but you know, they've had their moments. We've all had a breakup and listened to Long December at some point, right?
Sure.
You never have?
Not me personally, but this song is just excellent.
This soundtrack is excellent, and the range of the soundtrack. I mean, it does, of course, lean heavily on Britpop, but this is a perfect palate cleanser.
The two things that I remember from the DVD commentary is, one, this was supposed to be "To Sheila" by the Smashing Pumpkins,
which would have been great also.
The moment when he asks, "Are you okay?" comes from the writer-director's own experience when a girl lost his virginity to him in college. So again, straight man.
But I think that's considerate to check in.
Absolutely.
Of course, it's like they had already fucked, so they have that advantage. But it's also, I think it's like the realism of the fact that they're very sweaty. It is, you don't see a lot. It's very tightly shot, which is usually a pet peeve I have with sex scenes.
Oh, interesting.
Now people try too hard to make sex scenes not male gazey.
Right.
And the solution is just like close-ups of women's faces having orgasms and they're like hands grabbing someone's back. And like back in the day, we used to get just like a wide shot
of people fucking. Yeah. Sebastian's now a nice guy. And we know this because he fixes the doorman's bow tie. He's procured flowers for another person. He is stopped from giving flowers to whomever because he hears noises coming from Catherine's bedroom.
And wouldn't you know it, she's fucking Ronald. She's really horned up. at this particular point in the film, because then Ronald leaves and Sebastian's like, yeah, I fucked Annette. And she's like, okay, let's fuck now. And he's like, actually, I don't care.
Yeah. And he's like, I don't feel like it. She's like, but I do.
I want to fuck.
And this is when Catherine gaslights Sebastian into breaking up with Annette.
Wow. The power of female manipulation. There's literally no reason for him to do this.
Catherine's logic is your reputation is now toast. Like, your brilliant plan to bed the headmaster's daughter before school even starts is now ruined because you're now actually in love with this girl. You've gone soft. Like, what are you going to do? Raise money for the PTA.
He's still fucked the headmaster's daughter. It's almost even more of a flex that he's like parading around arm in arm with her, fucking her, while this man is like running the school.
Right, which is where her second point comes in, which is like, but if you're fine with that, actually, Annette nor her father know about your reputation. And actually, you're going to ruin her. It's basically the A Star Is Born logic where the manager goes up to Jackson Maine and is like, you're an embarrassment, so you shouldn't be around Lady Gaga. I think you know what to do. And he's like, kill myself? He's like, exactly. And then we get into the should I break up with her montage, which is him just sitting on the steps of the Met.
Yeah, listening to Amy Mann. Again, teenagers sitting on the steps of the Met is imagery I can't unwind from Gossip Girl.
It portrays a parallel world where teenagers are listening to Amy Mann. They are dressing like 30-year-olds. It was aspirational.
Society loves movies and TV shows where young people basically act like adults.
Of course. So montage ends. Guess what, Chelsea? Sebastian's going to break up with Annette. She shows him her new apartment or the apartment she'll be living in, which every time I see this movie, I'm like, that is a hotel room, but whatever. And this is such a brilliant performance by Ryan Phillippe because there's no heat behind his words. He's saying that he doesn't love her. I always expect him to be like, you were a bet, a stupid bet, but I'm like, that she's all that. Different 1999 bet teen movie. We love Annette because she's smarter than most of these characters, and she realizes that he's full of shit.
And her response is really perfect. It also feels so real. I'm not surprised because it's like they're actually dating. They're imagining what it would be like to break up. And they're young, so it's very like life or death type shit.
Yeah, these people are literally 22.
They had kids so young.
Speaking of which, I was also thinking this has to be so weird for their children. I doubt that they've watched this movie, but it's weird to see mom and dad when they were together simulating a breakup. And then she hauls off and slaps him, which I don't think was in the script. I do remember in the DVD commentary, he was so upset in making Reese Witherspoon cry that he vomited.
Which is fucked up of her to slap him without any warning. Imagine if that situation was reversed.
Yeah, you mean like how Dustin Hoffman slapped Meryl Streep on the set of Kramer versus Kramer?
Right, yes, exactly like that. So he leaves, he goes back to Catherine and is like, I did it, I broke it off, my reputation is intact, I have won the bet. Fuck me now.
And Catherine doesn't want to fuck him because
she doesn't fuck losers.
Oh.
Which I think this is really shitty. It's like she should hold up her end of the bet. That's what this whole fucking movie was about.
That's right. But I mean, he is quite losery.
I feel the same way watching Dangerous Liaisons. It's like Glenn Close, fuck him. This isn't fair. He did all this shit. He ruined Michelle Pfeiffer's life. Like, let him fuck you. You've already fucked. Who cares?
Yeah, she tells him, you gave up on the first person you ever loved because I threatened your reputation. Don't you get it? You're just a toy, Sebastian. A little toy I like to play with.
She's evil.
So we get our second Central Park montage where Sebastian is desperately trying to get Annette to talk to him. And then he's writing a note on top of his diary and he drops his diary off to Annette. He lets her know who he truly is. And I guess that's evidently what the diary is. It's not just his daily record of his life. He's like, oh, these are actually all of my conquests. So here's a nice digestible little novel for you of how I'm a terrible person. But now that you know who I am, and now you definitely know that this was a bet of me trying to fuck you, please give me another chance.
I know. It seems like a counterintuitive strategy to me.
It works.
But unfortunately, Catherine has already called Ronald and told him that he fucked Cecile. So now he's pissed. he finds Sebastian on the street.
Yeah, there's a great shot where Ryan Phillippe is leaving Central Park and it's all done in one shot. And then Annette sees him out the window. You know, wouldn't you know it? They all converge together on Central Park at the very same time.
Yes, and Annette tries to intervene with the fight between Ronald and Sebastian.
Well, Catherine tells one truth and a lie, right? Because Ronald says, Catherine says you hit her. And he goes, oh no, she's gotten to you too. And he's like, and she also said you fuck Cecile, which by Sebastian's face, you can tell, well, that part's true. And that's how the fight starts.
Yeah.
A little too close to traffic, but I will say the film, the book, Dangerous Liaisons, it's actually a duel, a sword fight. So it's very hard to update what that would be for the late 20th century. So this is about as good as you could do, which is a street fight in Central Park right next to where the traffic is.
I think it's kind of perfect. So Reese Witherspoon tries to intervene, gets knocked over, falls into traffic, and Ryan Phillippe selflessly saves her, sacrificing himself.
The only movie character to get hit by a car and actually die. Because it's like in action films, this exact scene would happen to like The Rock and he would be absolutely fine.
No, it's true. So he dies. What a bummer.
And his funeral is at school, question mark?
Yeah, I like to think he had a normal funeral, then that was just like his school-specific funeral. So Catherine is in the bathroom doing a bump before she has to deliver the eulogy. And who comes out of the bathroom stall but Annette, looking very hot in her school uniform, I must say.
Oh, okay.
Well, this is the first time we actually see them in uniforms.
And this is the first time these two characters are actually meeting, even though they know all about each other. So Catherine, because she is the student body president, is giving a eulogy in front of everyone about her brother. In the film, and I imagine the book, it's just as good, but this is pretty incredible, especially for updating what happens to Glenn Close's character, which is she's essentially ostracized
at the opera.
This is an amazing, like, one-to-one for teenagers at private school.
So she's giving her eulogy, and then people start to file out.
Slowly, then rapidly, to the point where she can't concentrate on the eulogy anymore, and she screams, "What the hell is going on?"
We then get the opening of Bittersweet Symphony, and she goes outside, and Cecile and Annette went to Kinko's and got like 10,000 copies of his diary printed out and spiral bound.
Beautiful. I would love to know Cecile's "What Did You Do This Summer" essay.
Everyone is reading it, and then they all kind of simultaneously look up at Catherine, and she sees it and is like, oh my God, he's writing about the bet. He's writing about my Coke spoon rosary.
And then just as she sees that, her father comes out and opens her Coke cross, which I'm like, how did he find out so fast?
I know, it's like everyone read like this entire diary in like 30 seconds.
As the music fully kicks in, Annette is driving Sebastian's car, which won't even get into the logic of the like,
how that worked out.
Yeah, that Catherine wasn't like, wait, where's Sebastian's car?
She goes to his parents. So I was fucking him like right before he died. And in fact, he died trying to save me. So can I just have his car?
That's what Sebastian was doing in one of those nighttime montages. He actually went to the law office to update his will. That's how adult these teenagers are. They each have their own living will and testament.
It's a perfect ending because we get Catherine's public shaming, which is quite satisfying as she is an evil, evil bitch. But we also get, unlike Dangerous Liaisons, we get a sort of more upbeat end beat for Annette.
Yeah, I mean, her first love is dead, but she's got a vintage Jaguar, so I guess it all equals out.
Yeah, she got revenge. Like, because she was the one that did it. In Dangerous Liaisons, it's like Ronald that distributes the letters. So it's nice that they gave that to Annette. That's a subversion of the original story, which otherwise it's like it is a very faithful adaptation.
Did Ronald end up going to Juilliard? Is he on trial for second degree manslaughter or something?
Yeah, I didn't really think about that. But it's truly such a perfect ending, and the song adds so much. And I've always been fascinated with that song because of the whole sampling drama with the Rolling Stones.
They originally wanted the Rolling Stones the last time to play.
Okay, that doesn't even make sense because have you ever actually heard The Last Time by the Rolling Stones? I will play a little snippet of it now. So when I first listened to this song in college, I was like, wait, how could the Verve possibly be sampling that song? It sounds absolutely nothing like Bittersweet Symphony. So that was an early Rolling Stones hit. And in the 60s and 70s, it was very commonplace for orchestras to cover like entire albums by rock artists and pop artists. So basically what happened is the Andrew Oldham Orchestra, Andrew Oldham was the Rolling Stones manager. He was like, you know what? I'm just going to cut to the chase and like do this whole orchestra bootleg album myself. So he did. And what I'm going to play you now is the exact same part of the song that I just played for you. So what happened is that the Verve got the rights to the Andrew Oldham Orchestra cover of the song. They secured the rights through Decca Records. The album comes out, the single is released, and then they realize, holy shit, we never cleared the Rolling Stones song.
Mick Jagger went to the London School of Economics. This is a litigious fellow.
Yeah, so they ended up suing the Verve, and the Rolling Stones are Keith Richards, Mick Jagger, as well as their former manager, and also Andrew Oldham basically ended up all splitting the royalties. So the Verve never made any money off of this song at all. And Cruel Intentions spent $1 million acquiring the song for this film. It kind of just like fucked up that band forever because it was their biggest song and it wasn't profitable for them. But then, in a big twist, in 2019, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were like, here's the rights. That was fucked up of us. Like, we fully did not write this song, which they didn't. They obviously had zero creative that went into that song. So it's actually really fucked up. And I don't think people realize that it's like they didn't write that song. That instrumental was never in one of their songs. So anyway, I'm just the Verve truther over here.
Chell's really hoping for a Verve reunion concert at some point.
No, I'm not even like a huge Verve fan, but that is one of the best songs of that decade. The video was incredible. It was just such a major moment, and it sucked that it was just such a horrible nightmare for that band.
It all has a happy ending, sort of. Did they then get the retroactive publishing?
No. They didn't get, like, money back, so it's, like, from 2019 on, whenever someone wants to use Bittersweet Symphony, they'll get a check, but obviously the biggest time to cash in would be at the height of its popularity. Anyway, this was fun. And to close things off, of course, we have to play Bittersweet Symphony.
Which the Verve won't be getting any money from us for playing this, but...
No, they won't.
All right, bye, guys.
Bye.
change, I can change, I can change.